Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Landers, founding publisher of the JSOM. I'd like to thank you for joining the JSOM's 20th anniversary interview series. We are excited to bring together a host of experts, all leaders in the soft medical community. In these interviews, we will be discussing the ever-evolving methods of treating battlefield trauma and injury and how those methods have changed over the 20 years since the JSOM's inception. I hope you'll find these talks as informative as we do.
And welcome back. Today, we've got the privilege of speaking with perhaps one of the most renowned members of our community, Master Sergeant retired Harold Montgomery, who is so famous. He goes by one name, Monty, just like Cher, Bono, and all those other fantastic members of our community. Perhaps he's even the Ranger previously known as Monty. And for those of you who need a little bit of a refresher, I can't recommend enough the interview in JSOM from 2015 by Dr. Craig, which does a great job outlining most of your extensive amount of time in the soft community. And if I remember correctly, sir, I believe you went to selection for the Rangers in 1990, 30 years ago. Is that right?
That would be correct. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yes, 30 years ago.
Fantastic. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your life in SOF and where you are today? I heard you're quite involved with continuing our medical care and leadership within SOF and DOD writ large.
Sure. I mean, most of my time was spent in the Ranger Regiment, in some manner of speaking, being attached to other SOF units and interacting with other SOF units, but fundamentally Ranger Medic most of the time, and then progressing up through the ranks and a good bit of my time in the regiment being the Regimental Senior Medic. And that whole time was part of the global war on terrorism of the deployed regiment that was consistently deployed and supporting all the operations. And then after time at regiment and multiple deployments with multiple task forces, went and culminated my career up at US SOCOM as a senior enlisted medical advisor before retiring, and tried to energize the community on a lot of the, not just efforts that we had done in the Ranger Regiment, but I think efforts that we as senior medics across the board had all been trying to get in motion for a good while. And that really kind of became my focus as I got up to SOCOM and got the balls rolling on a few different projects, from the Joint Medical Enlisted Advisory Council to Board of Command Surgeons, and some of those things that, even though they had existed for a while, they had kind of drifted off in the importance to the organizations out there, and try to get them focused again on the unit requirements and fulfilling that through training, equipping, and future development, and looking out forward to get the right focus for the future. And then after retirement, kind of back to my roots with tactical medicine and focusing mainly on tactical combat casualty care, TC3, and working directly with Frank Butler and the committee on TC3 for the last few years, and continuing on with that now. Talked into taking on a greater role in SOMA, which has now become a very professional hobby, which TC3 work was kind of my professional hobby before, but it's become my profession now. So the special operations medicine, and primarily through SOMA, has become my professional hobby at this point, and really trying to take SOMA to a different place than it was, you know, when I was a junior medic going to those events years ago. Because all too often back then, you know, SOMA was the conference and the conference was SOMA. And even though we did great things at the event, it didn't really amount to much throughout the rest of the year. Being a SOMA member didn't really do anything for you the rest of the time. And one of my goals as being a leader within SOMA is trying to change that and make SOMA something that is either doing something for the medics out there, or something the medics can tap into on a daily basis or weekly basis. And it's not just an annual event. It's something that they use all the time and are part of all the time.
Yeah, and I think we've all seen some dramatic changes for the better over the past few years from the SOMSA. So thank you so much for that. Well, I think the topic we had discussed chatting about today was TC3 and its role within the Ranger Regiment. And so our first question is, what was the origin of this practice? Does this come from the civilian or military world?
Well, it's a little of both in a way. Rangers were always about mastery of the basics. And when I think back of when I first got to the Ranger Regiment, and it wasn't even just the Rangers, but it was soft medicine and military medicine at large, we were heavily focused on civilian-based training and requirements. So we looked at EMT and paramedic as kind of a reference point. We looked at ATLS, Advanced Trauma Life Support, as a reference point for what we needed to be training. There wasn't really a lot of research and science going into the best practices of military medicine, and military medicine focused on pre-hospital and the tactical setting. We kind of just ran with what we knew based off of old military practices that had been in place for decades before, back to World War II and into Vietnam, combined with a heavy focus on the current civilian practices and certifications, you know, at the time. And by being masters of the basics, we were mastering on those. Until the TC3 advent and the flash to flame that it was in the late 90s, we didn't completely realize that our focus was a little off. And even though we were training hard, training good, we were kind of training to the wrong requirement. And TC3 was kind of a wake-up call for that, and for us to realize that we were mastering things, but we were mastering, you know, along the wrong problem set, the wrong injury patterns, the wrong management for the different types of injuries that would be incurred in combat. I think we were preparing ourselves very well for the common civilian injury patterns of motor vehicle accidents and low velocity gunshots and stabbings, but not so much for the dynamics of the combat situation and the preventable combat deaths that go along with that. So I think TC3 was a huge wake up call for that.
Yeah, I certainly remember the old tactical medical training when you'd have guys out under direct fire trying to intubate a patient while somebody else is providing cover fire from behind the down patient. In retrospect, that was just a terrible idea.
Yep.
And so you've touched on it a little bit, but our next question was, what was the trigger that really created the interest in creating a unique military tactical practice different from civilian EMS practices?
Well, like I said, I think it was TC3 and Frank Butler and his team that really started in the early 90s of just looking at the problem set in a different way of, you know, what are the right injury patterns that we need to be focused on? What are ways to prevent the injuries and then manage those injuries in a way to prevent death? So, I mean, that project had actually been ongoing since really around 92, 93. But for the Ranger specific side, it was kind of a perfect storm situation around the 96 to 98 timeframe. We had the Rangers and Special Operations Task Force that was kind of reeling from the events in Somalia in 93, where we had kind of that smack in the face realization that, you know, our guys can die and get wounded, and we didn't feel we were perfectly prepared for it. Combined with the leadership at the time within the Ranger Regiment that recognized that as well. So it was a medic realization of that and a leadership realization of that. So we had the leaders with Stan McChrystal and Mike Hall, you know, commander and sergeant major at the time, who had that realization and kind of allowed the medical people who had that realization, as well as the entire regiment, of that, hey, we need to do better for medicine. So one of their focuses was that medical and medical training was part of the big four of Ranger training, along with marksmanship, physical fitness, and small unit tactics, that medical training had to be part of that. So was that there was that leadership focus, the realization of the regiment that we were not supermen and could take injuries and our guys could die, the right medical people who had the smack in the face themselves and, you know, realized, hey, we can do this better. And then at that same time, as part of the perfect storm, was TC3 coming out with the journal article in 96. So all four of those things kind of happening all at the same time. It, in my opinion, it was definitely a perfect storm to set us up for success, that we started relooking at everything we were doing, from training to equipping and to who we were training and who we were equipping with everything, so that we were far better prepared and far out in front of most units when it came time for the war to start in 2001, because many of those things that had been kind of theories before, we started validating as training within the regiment. And then when 9/11 happened and we were deployed immediately after, those things were already built into being habits that soon over the next 2 to 3 years, became huge lessons learned and best practices that the larger services, especially the Army and the Marine Corps, started to adopt, we already had in place as almost unit SOP. So in many ways, the Ranger Regiment, you know, during that time frame was a reference point for others to look at to see how should they do things within their unit. So the advent of the Ranger First Responder Program for every Ranger getting TC3 training, and that slowly converting into the Army Combat Lifesaver Program, as well as what we were training our medics, and to a large degree, not just the skills, but how we were trying to validate that medics were ready to deploy and be in a combat situation and have all the right skills and have practiced the right skills, and the doc, the PA, and the senior medic of each unit had validated those skills, started to be something that the greater forces started looking at as a model to go forward.
Well, certainly, I mean, considering how incredibly kinetic the Rangers have been over the past 20 years and their dramatically lower wounding and fatality rate in COTWOL's data has certainly supported that argument that though they put themselves at risk and may be injured, their risk of dying is significantly lower due to that perfect storm that you certainly mentioned. And I think you touched on this a bit, but the next question is, who is the topic of TC3 currently offered to? Because it's extended out beyond just the original, started in the Navy Surface Special Warfare, right? And then was the Rangers the second group to pick it up?
Yeah, for the most part, the Rangers and the pararescue folks were the next ones to take a hard look and adopt it into the organizations and start using it as more or less an SOP of training and execution. I think the Rangers as a unit, as an organization, was a little bit better facilitated for putting it across the entire force because it was one unit. The disadvantage the PJs had was that, I mean, PJs are individuals throughout many of their other units. So it was a little bit different scenario with them. But we still had the same struggle both on the Ranger side, the PJ side, and throughout the SF medic world of trying to re-educate a generation that had been educated a certain way before. So myself being one of them. I mean, eventually we would all become the dinosaurs, you know, that predated TC3. But I mean, at that point through the late 90s, we had a lot of self-indoctrination or re-indoctrination of, hey, remember that way we were trained for years? Okay, stop. Let's do it this way now. We're going to take a whole 180 spin on how we did things. And I'll be honest, there was a time when many individuals had a big struggle in trying to make that accommodation. I mean, I wasn't an easy turn myself. I initially struggled with a lot of it. But I think what that whole phenomenon taught us, and not just Rangers, but I think the soft medical community, was to, one, be more self-critical in that we can do things better and let's find ways to do things better. But at the same time, it taught us to ask the hard questions of, hey, instead of me just blindly doing this, what's the evidence behind me doing this? You know, am I fulfilling the right requirement? Am I training with the right tools and the right procedure for the right problem sets? Because I think that was one of the realizations with us training to civilian practice for so long and not a military focus, is that we kind of realized we were training for the wrong thing. So I think in the long run, and what has prevailed to this day, I think, within soft medicine, is we take a hard look at ourselves and are we doing the right thing the right way with the right tools? But also, if I'm going to change what I'm doing, am I doing it right? Is there evidence that says, you know, I should do it this way using this tool and this method versus that one? So I think that is another phenomenon that came out of that time frame that has really carried over and become much of what soft medicine is now, and how soft medicine kind of leads the way for most of military medicine, certainly on the pre-hospital and role one focus, and even now delving well into role two with our surgical, soft surgical teams of, you know, how can we do things better? The larger services can adopt and look at in the long run.
Oh boy. Yeah. Well, after the meeting that you and I sat through last week for the Committee on Surgical Combat Casualty Care, I think that list of improving role two surgical teams is pretty long.
But,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that about having to take a hard look at practice patterns. That sounds exactly like a lot of the physician education dogma that we've always been told, which is that, you know, 50% of what we're taught in medical school ends up being wrong. We just don't know which 50% that is that we're taught. And recently, there's been a big push to change from the old days of what was known as eminence-based medicine, of the old guy who'd always dentist said to do it that way, and that's how we're going to do it, pivoting to evidence-based medicine. I'm really excited to see that. And so who is the current audience of TC3?
Yeah, so I guess I drifted away from the topic a little bit because one of the struggles that we've had early in the process was, you know, getting medics trained and all medics across the board trained to a certain standard. And, you know, each of the services, different units, different organizations, all taking grasp of the program and TC3 guidelines and even the offered curriculum that was out there and kind of running with it to train their people. But what happened is it wasn't happening in a good standardized way. So even though all the services and especially the Army and Marines and SOF have adopted TC3 and have it well integrated into their programs, and that's not to undermine the training that medics are getting right now, because right now we have medics and corpsmen and PJs that are far better and trained in TC3 than really, in my opinion, they've been trained in any other skill level before. But we still have a huge gap in that we aren't training the docs and PAs that supervise them. So even though early on in the process, we were training to the wrong standard, then we shifted and we trained our medics well. Now we've got a new problem set that medics are trained well out there, but their supervising docs and PAs are not focused on it. So they don't know what the capabilities and expectations of their medics trained in TC3 are because they don't have a good understanding of TC3 themselves. What we're trying to do is rebuild the entire tiered levels of tactical combat casualty care training from the basic all service members all the way up to paramedics and providers and what the expectations are at each level. So the lowest level or the most basic level is the TC3 for all service members. Now, as we went into this working group and curriculum development a little over a year ago now, we were thinking, okay, we're just going to adopt the existing TC3 all combatants into something for, you know, all service members. And for Army and Marine Corps, that's kind of what they were thinking all service members would look like because we all knew what TC3 was and what was needed. You know, the Army and Marines have tasted a lot of combat, a lot of casualties. It was a pretty clear understanding. But as we started looking at it and started truly looking at the definition of all service members, you start having the realization that not everybody in the DoD pulls out their guns and is in a gunfight on a regular basis. When it comes to any asset within the Air Force and the Navy, they're not in gunfights. There is still risk. There is still a sense of combat. There is force on force, but it's not the gunfight in the same way that much of TC3 was designed for. So the tenets of care under fire kind of become a slightly different focus with a care under threat. So we didn't want things to be so basic that it was only stop the bleed and nothing else. The whole idea of the TC3 context for everyone is that you're not just dealing with bleeding. You're not just dealing with an injury. You're dealing with bleeding or an injury in a situation. So you've got to be able to deal with the situation along with the patient. I mean, that's the most basic fundamentals of TC3. Before you get into anything with needle decompressions or tourniquets or any of the high-speed stuff we're doing or the basics that we're doing, it's really about conducting all of those things at the right time and the right place within a situation. So, I mean, that was a key piece that we wanted to make sure was in all service members and so that it applied to everybody, so that it was something usable to the ground combatants, but just as usable to a sonar tech on a submarine or the bomb loader, you know, at an Air Force base. Injuries happen in all those locations and situations. The fundamentals of what we have to do to stop bleeding, to deal with burns, airway management, or anything like that, the fundamentals are the same in a threat situation across the board, whether it's a gunfight or an aircraft accident or a fire on a ship. The fundamentals are the same. So that's where we tried to focus with ASM. So, I mean, from some people's perspective who have been looking at TC3 for years and years and years, they're going to see ASM as, well, wait, this isn't quite TC3. And it's like, well, it is and it isn't. It's the principles of TC3 apply to any high threat situation, you know, from a military perspective. That's really where we tried to get with the ASM level. The next level up is the TC3 Combat Lifesaver, or Tier 2, as we call it. But really, CLS is going to be the predominant name. And it's not so much a takeover of the existing CLS programs, but more of a standardization of the content and a means of keeping that content up to date. all combat lifesaver training with whichever service, but predominantly Army and Marines, will be getting the same content based off the same skill levels and expectations. In many ways, it epitomizes what was the existing TC3 all combatants combined with the program the Army Combat Lifesaver was built around. Which, I mean, granted, it was focused on what was previously Ranger First Responder, which was a descendant of TC3. So it's not like things were out of line. We're really just synchronizing the two efforts into one program so that everyone knows what they're getting with TC3 Combat Lifesaver is, you know, whether you want to call it the Army Combat Lifesaver program or TC3 CLS, the idea is we have one standardized content across the board. But this is more your traditional ground combat-based TC3 training. So the primary audience for TC3 Combat Lifesaver are truly your combatants. So your infantry, your armor, your artillery, and then, you know, kind of on a Navy and Air Force perspective, a little bit more towards the either enablers that go out with ground forces. So, I mean, certainly all your ground call for fire guys, TACPs, and controllers, and those kind of guys that are with Army and Marine forces. But then also for like security forces or security police and MPs and that kind of thing that deal with base security, especially when deployed, they're dealing with that kind of situation. They're a little bit more the target audience for CLS because in a sense, they're more the infantry per se of the Air Force and the Navy. But then like Navy has other folks that are in that same category. So the riverine units and some of the maybe not so much on a ground force, but at a surface force far more inland than your standard Navy ship, but where gunfights and IEDs and that kind of thing is more the threat than incoming missiles and fires on a ship, where the traditional TC3 preventable death injuries and injury patterns and practices is a little bit more the focus. So the next level is focused for the basic corpsman and medic, so the third level. And this is TC3 medics and corpsmen. Previously, this has kind of been called TC3 for medical personnel, but we're really focusing the third level on, you know, your basic medic. So this is your entry level medic and corpsman out there. So that the initial entry, when they first come into the military, this would be the TC3 level they're getting with their medic training. And then that is their mastery of the basics going forward. So this is much more the traditional TC3 we've all known and trained for so many years, but doesn't go into a lot of the advanced procedures. Not a heavy focus on the why. I mean, really, if you really want to look at each of the levels, all service members and the combat lifesaver are fundamentally I see something, I do something in a situation. With the third level, the medic level, we want them to see something, do something, and then do something else based off what they've done. So be able to get the sequencing effect of hemorrhage control, airway management, analgesia, fluid resuscitation of what do I do as the next step. So we're expecting them to remember and understand and have the skills for taking on multiple tasks for multiple casualties is really what we're looking for the medic piece, but not delving so much into the why behind some of these. So we won't overload that curricula with the evidence and the science behind many of the things, just because as a junior guy, that's not necessarily the core of what we're wanting them to know right then. We want them to be able to execute these things. I'm not saying that they shouldn't ask questions or shouldn't know that, but I mean, the fundamentals of what they must know and must be able to do are the basic skills and the mastery of those skills. But that leads into what is the highest level of TC3, which we're calling TC3 for paramedics and providers. But this is more of, granted, it's the advanced skills that we've kind of come to include with soft medics and paramedics and what a provider should be able to do. But it's really looking into the why behind things. And understanding and being able to explain to juniors and be the higher level instructor. So, I mean, our ultimate goal is that different TC3 sites or units that they would operate at the tier 4 level or the paramedic provider level and be able to provide instruction and sustainment training at the unit level or the training site where they're more or less the experts and the SMEs in TC3 and can explain and go into detail on the why behind the different evidence and procedures.
That's going to be exciting for the listenership and the community to see that come to fruition. And just as a plug for anyone out there saying that sounds great and all, but how do I get mine? don't forget that anyone in any branch of service is always welcome to come here to San Antonio to the Defense Medical Readiness Training Institute, the DMRTI, which you can find on the Googles, and their C4 course, the Combat Casualty Care course, is a fantastic 5-day course that includes a TC3 course and some FTXs as well for those junior providers who may not have been exposed to that and really would benefit from exactly what you just said, Monty, about understanding what your medic capability is before you go supervise them. So I can't foot stomp that enough for new folks out there who weren't aware. And then I guess our last question here is tying into all those great things that have been researched, curriculum developed, and implemented. And so really we want to end with the question of how have we quantified the benefit from TC3, both within the Rangers in general and the military writ large, and how those benefits have applied to injured service members?
Well, I wish I had great, perfect answers for that. But I mean, we're looking at it from many directions. So, I mean, we try to go with what data we have in the DoD trauma registry, but it is based off what data has been input. So, I mean, that is mostly based off of role 2 and higher treatment records. And what it severely lacks is the pre-hospital documentation and data that hasn't been input. And hasn't been received. So, I mean, much of that comes back on guys like what I used to be, of the guy on the ground who doesn't document things well or doesn't report it after the fact, that I think we could improve on. I mean, looking back on it, had I known, I could have done much of that much better in my younger days. Not documenting something is not really squaring somebody away, whether it's their annual physical or a DD-1380 casualty card. Not documenting is not helping them, and it's not helping the system. And it doesn't help get you the right training and right equipment down the road. Even though documentation always seems like an extra pain for all of us, it does so much for us, the individual provider type, and the patient themselves in the long run. So whether you're looking at it for the patient, and that's a VA record that is going to help them get benefits when they retire or get out of the military, but as the medic or provider, it's part of what drives the ability to get the right equipment. Without the data that is captured from that documentation, then it's hard to quantify what it is we need to train on and focus on for equipment and education down the road. So, I mean, it's critical that we, the medics out there, take the time to document and tell the story of what happened. And in many ways, that's a good way to look at it, is you're telling the story. So even if you were only able to get a sparse amount of information on a 1380 that is attached to the casualty, that is critical for getting information to the next level of care of what you did, taking a step back after the mission and submitting a good casualty after action review and getting into all the details of what went right, what went wrong, what procedures you did, what tools you used, and submitting that up to JTS, that's where we can truly quantify a lot of data. So when I say documentation, I'm not completely saying, oh, this has to be done on your knees in the mud, in the rain, in the cold, and on a little sheet or on a digital thing that you hope gets to the next level. Sometimes it's after the fact and taking the time to document that and send it in as a separate endeavor after the fact. I know many times we would come off mission, the thing is going through your head, you know, after mission, when you're back to the FOB, you're going to chow, cleaning weapons, you know, and that kind of thing. You're thinking of all the things that went right, went wrong, timelines. It's the time to capture, you know, the good AAR. We do it with so many other things, you know, operationally and as the unit, but we don't necessarily do a good job of that as medics or as a medical system. And this is the opportunity for it. The most simplistic form can be just taking the time to fill out a DD-1380 to its ultimate accuracy a day after the incident and send that in. It's more data than what we would have had otherwise most of the time. Ideally, it's sitting down and doing the complete casualty AAR and actually sending that in, and we can extract huge amounts of data from those after action reports that then help us quantify what are our medics seeing, what equipment do they need, what training do they need, and what does our focus for research, development, testing and evaluation of training and equipment and everything down the road, what's our focus for the future? So even though there may not be a that day gratification, if I did this AR and sent it in, in the long run, it's going to help out the guy on the ground and get them the right training and equipment if it's based off the right data points.
Yeah, what a great reminder of the bigger picture of the importance of the TC3 card. And actually, while you were saying that, it came full circle with me that's also where we started with TC3. It was based on that wounded combat data and identifying those injury patterns that we could then make appropriate intervention recommendations on. So that's pretty fun, and where we started. And for those few folks out there who haven't read probably the penultimate publication about combat data, it is a mandatory read, and I'm looking at it right here. It's the Eliminating Preventable Death on the Battlefield from 2011. And Monty, I'm sorry, I completely forgot that you are actually the second author on that manuscript. In addition to just an all-star cast of authors, it really reinforces exactly what you said, that with excellent training, equipping, and data, the regiment was able to get its died of wounds rate down to 1.7%, which was remarkably better than the DOD writ large at 5.8%, which just brings home the point that these are such important interventions for our young sons and daughters who are at the tip of the spear, that we have to have good data to bring them home. And I think if it's okay with you, sir, I'd love to end today with a quote that I got out of your interview from 2015. And I think it's an important take-home lesson to remind us of the importance of our people. And what you said was, when you are right and you know you are right, then you have a moral obligation to force your will on others. I see this as a basic test of any agenda, project, endeavor, or cause I have ever pushed along. If it's the right thing to do, then do it regardless of the obstacles. Policies can be changed, equipment can be changed, techniques can be changed, whatever can be changed. What matters is whether people will ram through the resistance and push the change to make things right. And I think that's really where we are today with TC3.
And I've been trying to live by that principle for at least the last decade and a half or so, ever since I heard that quote in a COTC meeting years ago. It's actually attributed to a British journal back in the 1800s, where it was first said of the do the right thing regardless sort of concept. But as a mindset, I kind of put it in those words that you read there. I had that in a little framed thing above my desk since probably the early 2000s, and still keep it today.
Well, sir, thank you so much for your time, insight, and most importantly, thank you for what you have done and what you continue to do for our community of special operations medics and the operators that we serve and are beholden to.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.